The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
We've been talking this hour about reparations, a policy that would give some kind of compensation to the descendants of people who were enslaved or who suffered from legal discrimination right up until recent times. This is usually thought of in terms of government programs of one kind or another, but we've also begun to see steps toward what we might call voluntary reparations. Georgetown University could make history this year with the first slavery reparations program ever proposed by a student body on themselves. Our producer, Kalalia, went to find out what it's all about.
In 2016, a chef in New Orleans named Melisande Short Colombe was working her shift when she got this Facebook message.
Hi, Melisande. You don't know me. I'm a genealogist in Baton Rouge. I'm doing some research on the Mahoney family. Was your grandmother related to them? If you're interested in the family history, I'll be happy to share what I have. Many thanks, Judy.
I looked at the message, I read it 2 times, I turned it off and I put it back in my pocket and I went back to work.
Melisande, or Melly, finished her shift, ate a grilled cheese sandwich, then responded.
I wrote her back that I was not related to that family and I gave her a written list of the people that I knew going back 7 generations who were my ancestors in Louisiana. They asked me if I would do a DNA test. They sent it to me. I gave them the samples, sent it off, and I went on vacation. And for 2 weeks, the only thing I did was do the research that I had never done. Having the information that I had from my family, I drank painkillers and I sat at my computer.
If you're wondering about drinking painkillers, so was I.
It is not a pill. It is a rum-based drink that you make in batches and pour over ice.
Okay. Melly already knew that her ancestors had come to Louisiana from Maryland. But the genealogist told her something she did not know, that her ancestors, the Mahoneys, had been kept as slaves by Jesuit priests.
What was going through your mind? What were you feeling?
Well, I have to be completely honest with you.
Yes.
It is one thing to know that you were enslaved, theoretically. It is another thing when you know that you were enslaved by men who identify as the Society of Jesus. There became somebody I could be mad at.
The Jesuits, who own her ancestors, were running Georgetown University in Washington, D.C. Melly's family were among nearly 300 people they sold in 1838 to work on sugarcane plantations in Louisiana.
We was cane cutters. We were sold to concentrated labor camps. So my family worked hard in the typical American way, except that in the beginning, we were enslaved and we worked for free.
Folks, right here would be my family.
Mm-hmm. What are their names? Can you read them?
Sure.
Robert and Mary. And Robert is 43, Mary is 35. Abraham, 16. Robert, 14. James, 12. Bridget, 11. Mary Jane, 10. Susan, 8.
Sally Ann,
7.
Nellie,
6.
Charles,
5. One child.
Somebody who's listed as one child. Those are Mahonies. There are other Mahonies as well.
Professor Adam Rothman has taught a class at Georgetown about the university's history with slavery.
You see those names in that document and other bills of sale. But at the same time, we have these sacramental registers. We have records kept by the Jesuits of people they baptized, they married, and they buried. So it seems to me that if you can understand how the Jesuits could baptize their slaves one day and sell them the next, then you have a pretty good grasp of the history of American slavery.
The Georgetown slave sale wasn't a secret. But after an article was published in the school newspaper in 2014, many students on campus began protesting. This was around the same time the police killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, and tensions were already high. College students all over the country were enraged. The president of Georgetown formed a working group to try to deal with the growing frustrations. And one alumnus who had been following the issue was Richard Cellini. He's a lawyer and businessman in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
I really stumbled into this by accident. I'm a moderate Republican. I'm a businessman. I'm a white person. I don't know anything about social justice. I don't know anything about genealogy.
But Richard decided to get involved. He sent an email.
Here's what I wrote to the senior member of the working group.
Who he didn't wish to name.
This whole controversy has been about Georgetown to date. What Georgetown did, what Georgetown thinks, what Georgetown feels, what Georgetown remembers, who Georgetown should honor, and who Georgetown should hire. In some respects, this is charmingly traditional. But I say this, who gives a flip about what is and what is not included in the official Georgetown campus tours? Georgetown itself. Reparations should be made where reparations are due, to the descendants of the 272 slaves that Father Mullady sold to a plantation in Louisiana in 1838. Georgetown should stop talking about what Georgetown should be doing to or for Georgetown, and focus instead on what Georgetown should be doing for the people it abandoned so very long ago.
Richard sent the message in November of 2015, and on the very same day he got this response.
Dear Richard, the problem with making some sort of reparation to the descendants of the slaves sold south is that, as far as we can tell, all of them quickly succumbed to a fever in the malodorous swamp world of Louisiana. I had students do a research project a couple of years back to see if we could locate their descendants. The best available evidence suggests that almost all of them immediately succumbed to the hostile climate and the harsh labor conditions into which they were so suddenly and cruelly submitted. And I must have read it three or four times, and I just stared at it in disbelief because I thought, this just isn't possible. Even the Titanic had survivors.
And Richard was right, because it was completely untrue. He started doing his own research. Within weeks, he founded a nonprofit independent of the university. He named it the Georgetown Memory Project. The genealogist who had asked Melly about her ancestors in 2016 was hired by the Memory Project. So far, they've identified 4,000 living descendants of the roughly 300 people sold in 1838, and they're still looking.
To the members of the descendant community, many of you who have traveled long distances to be here.
At Georgetown, the institution was doing what institutions do. Two campus buildings were renamed, and a Department of African American Studies was founded. In 2017, a remembrance ceremony was held.
By the legacy of slavery that involves us all personally, I welcome you all to our liturgy of remembrance, of contrition, of hope.
Mele had come from New Orleans to be at the remembrance ceremony that day. She had learned of one additional benefit the university would offer. All 4,000 living descendants of enslaved people would be granted legacy status, meaning that if they applied for admission to Georgetown, they'd be given special consideration, like the children of alumni.
I was feeling a little itchy, maybe, about something to do. My back was hurting, my arms were tired, I'd been cooking too long, and I started thinking about, what am I going to do with the rest of my life? And lo and behold, fill out an application to Georgetown University really just popped up into my mind.
At the age of 63, Mele was accepted to Georgetown University. She's a sophomore now.
Welcome to Georgetown.
Thank you.
Yeah, we have a lot going on around here these days. The semester is coming to an end. Spring has sprung. Finals are soon to begin. And
I visited Mele in the final week of classes. She stands out on campus. Her hair is gray and cut short, and she's wearing loose pants, not leggings or jeans, more like what you wear at the beach. Mele is one of five descendants who currently attend Georgetown.
So when I first got here, I had my clothes, a bed that was up too high in the air, and I had to climb up into my bed at night, and I haven't slept in the air like that ever in my life, really.
Like bunk beds.
I didn't do bunk, you know. I never did a bunk bed thing. So that was a little different. And the last 2 years.
In her second semester, Mele joined a student-led group, the GU 272 Advocacy Group. They felt that the university's response hadn't been enough. Legacy status is a start, but it only benefits those who have a chance of getting accepted to a highly selective school. They had a more significant demand in mind, a reparations fund to benefit all the descendants. Something no educational institution has ever done. And they got a referendum on reparations introduced to the student body, which would be a small surcharge added to the tuition bill for undergrads. It was intensely debated on campus.
In the coming months, the GU 272 advocacy team will try to convince you that the obligations of Georgetown's sins fall squarely on its student body.
Truthfully, I couldn't get a single anti-referendum student to talk to me on the record, but an editorial in the student paper expressed one common view.
While we agree that the Georgetown of today would not exist if not for the sale of 272 slaves in 1838, current students are not to blame for the past sins of the institution, and a financial contribution cannot reconcile this past debt on behalf of the university.
I talked to a student named Javon Price, who was against the students paying reparations until he attended a town hall meeting on campus. He's a member of the College Republicans as well as the ROTC.
What made me go to the town hall was the fact that I was undoubtedly against the referendum to begin with. At the town hall event, I raised my hand and I said, why should I? Why do I, as an African-American student and as a descendant of slaves myself, be required to pay any type of fee to address the university's sin of slavery, of enslavement, selling of human beings? Why do I have to contribute to this as an African-American student when at the end of the day, this has affected me and my community as well?
Mele was sitting in front of Javon at the time.
And I turned around in my seat and I looked at him directly and I said to him, you had the choice. You have the choice to come here, and every student who comes to this campus comes believing that there is something here that they will receive that will benefit them in the rest of their lives. The people who were sold and enslaved for 150 years, their lack of voice and choice provided for everybody here to choose to walk through the gates to receive their benefit and to take that out into the world and leverage that to make their lives better, the world better, and their families better.
And what were you thinking at the moment when she said that to you? What was going through your head? What did you say?
The moment I got Melly's response, I sat back down, and quite frankly, I shut up, and I listened for the rest of the town hall. And I allowed myself at that moment to just receive the information that I had been rejecting.
The reparations fee was pretty small, 0.1% of tuition. But the students I talked to compared this moment to the era of the Vietnam War. Everybody felt that there was something much larger at stake. Are we going to stop talking about the legacy of slavery and just do something about it? The vote took place on April 11th.
Results overnight show students at Georgetown University support paying reparations to help atone for the school's past. Undergraduates voted overwhelmingly yesterday in favor of a $27 per semester fee to benefit descendants of 272 slaves who were sold by the school in the 1800s.
The students' vote is non-binding, but Georgetown takes student government very seriously. It would be hard for the Board of Trustees to simply ignore it. And if they act on the vote, Georgetown will make history as the first educational institution to make financial reparations for slavery. The money would go into a fund to be used by the descendants for education, microloans, or healthcare expenses. The details are still being discussed, though.
When people say today, this is all about money, my answer is, of course it's about money. It's always been about money.
Again, that's Richard Cellini, who founded the Georgetown Memory Project.
Money is what was taken from these families, and so in restitution, money is what must be given.
I'd been wondering why the Jesuits themselves haven't made reparations. The order recently sold some of its land to the state of Maryland for a reported $57 million. I put the question to Father Matthew Carnes, a Jesuit priest who teaches in the government department at Georgetown.
How come there hasn't been a gesture, a financial gesture on the part of the Jesuit organization, who clearly have a lot of money, or at least it seems that way?
Well, you know, Dennis, that's something that's going forward, is a conversation. Georgetown, the Jesuits, and the descendants have worked with the Kellogg Foundation to actually have a structured set of conversations now about what might this look like. And that, I think, will lead to significant commitments. I'm not the head of the Jesuits. So I don't know what those commitments will look like. But it strikes me that we need to really listen to one another.
He didn't quite answer the question. But I left campus feeling hopeful about this young generation who voted for the referendum. They've chosen to see it as their collective responsibility. They're doing what their elders and ancestors could not or would not do. And Father Carnes put his finger on something. Something that I heard from a lot of students. They're taking reparations personally.
And if people asked, you know, what should you learn from this? When it actually puts you in spaces where you realize my own privilege means that I have opportunities that I have to think about, are there ways for me to relinquish them or share them? Do I need to admit that I have taken pride in things that I've seen as achievements of my own that, you know, may really be built on the backs of others? That's a humbling thing to do. I think that we should always feel uncomfortable with this history. It should always ask us about how now, whatever, 2039, should we be addressing this legacy in our country? We shouldn't say, well, you know, in 2019, we did this and we put it behind us. There will always be a way at which we need to ask ourselves these hard questions.
The referendum results will go before Georgetown's board in June. As of now, they have no deadline for making a decision.
I hope that all of the parents and every professor and the administration, whatever their personal feelings are about the referendum, that they admire the initiative of the students. Maybe you'll have the occasion to come back again. This is not the end of the story.
Yeah.
At all.
No, it's the beginning.
That's Kalalea, a producer for the New Yorker Radio Hour, and she spoke with Melisande Short-Colombe.